Der ZZF-Podcast. Aus dem Leibniz-Zentrum für zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam.
Welcome to our second episode of the English language edition of the ZZF podcast at the Leibniz Center for Contemporary Historical Research in Potsdam, Germany. I'm your host, Lee Holt, and today I'm speaking with Ned Richardson-Little. Ned is a research fellow in Department 5, Globalizations in a Divided World, at the Leibniz Center for Contemporary History in Potsdam. He completed his BA and MA at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and his PhD at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He was previously a Freigeist Fellow in the Department of History at the University of Erfurt, leading the Volkswagen Stiftung-funded research group, The Other Global Germany, Deviant Globalization and Transnational Criminality in the 20th Century. He is the author of The Human Rights Dictatorship, Socialism, Global Solidarity, and Revolution in East Germany, from Cambridge University Press, published in 2020, and The German Democratic Republic, The Rise and Fall of a Cold War State, published by Bloomsbury in 2025. His latest projects are a history of international narcotics trafficking in Germany from the imperial era to the present day, and as principal investigator on the Volkswagen Stiftung-funded project Towards a Liberal Constitutionalism in East Central Europe, Historical Analysis in Comparative and Transnational Perspectives, where he's researching the uses of GDR history by the German far right in both its online social media outreach and in pursuit of an ethno-nationalist constitutional order. Ned, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by asking you a personal question. How did you become interested in German history? Was there a moment when you thought, this is what I want to do with my life?
It wasn't a single moment, but when I got to university, I really got drawn into Cold War history. I grew up in an environment in Canada in the 1990s where my local surroundings and politics of that era were very post-ideological. It was very much sort of the end of history. It was a period where you had this sort of total hegemony of the centrist Liberal Party. And yet almost everyone I knew growing up were people who had fled from much more interesting national histories. A lot of people I knew were coming from places that had been through civil war, gone through different conflicts, and had come to Canada to basically get away from too much history, to go to a place where people seemed to think there wasn't very much of it. And I think getting into the Cold War, the sort of the question of it, having such a commitment to different forms of ideology, this sort of question about sort of big ideas of politics was so incredibly foreign to me and where I'd come from. And this was really sort of my gateway into German history. It wasn't so much Germany specifically, but really GDR history as a gateway into the rest of German history.
Your most recent publication is The German Democratic Republic, The Rise and Fall of a Cold War State. And I wanted to ask you, what is the book about and how did this book come about?
The book initially came about because of a series that Bloomsbury is putting together, and it's really meant to be two books at once. On the one hand, it's meant to be a readable narrative history of the GDR. So if you just want to know generally what occurred over the 40-year life of East Germany, how it was founded, how it developed, and eventually how it fell apart and collapsed, that's there. At the same time, it's also meant to be an introduction to the most recent development in the field and an effort to try and create a synthesis of the last 30 years of academic scholarship so that in one readable text, you can get a sense of what has been happening, what people have been innovating on, and what are the latest areas that are still in development in the field of East German history.
And this book is a rather slim volume, considering you're packing so much into it. What were the challenges in writing this book for you?
I was under a very strict word limit from the publisher because they really wanted to keep it a certain price point, a certain size, so they could sell it for students. Based on the writing of this, I ended up blowing through that word limit and having to get into a bit of a fight with the publisher, and it all worked out in the end. But in the end, one of the biggest challenges of a book like this is making sure that you don't end up having to talk about the same topic twice and having to restrain yourself from going down the many enjoyable rabbit holes that you come across. On the one hand, you're trying to provide this sort of big picture political history so people sort of know who Walter Ulbricht and Erich Honecker, the two main leaders of the Socialist Unity Party, are, that you get a sense of the geopolitics of how a country is created. But then getting into things like film production, gay subcultures, what it meant to be Afro-German in East Germany, the experiences of people who were involved in dissident movements, how does the Stasi function? There's all these different topics that people find interesting that you have to cater to because that's what they're expecting in a book like this, as well as to cover all of the topics that have generally been neglected and have really been on the cutting edge of academic scholarship. So really, it's sort of making sure that on the one hand, including as much as possible, doing justice to these topics, but also coming to terms with the fact that you're never going to actually be able to cover anything in any great amount of depth. And having to trust that if people are really excited about something, that the book is very heavily endnoted so that there's a sort of trail of breadcrumbs you can follow to get to a much longer text on basically any topic that's in there.
So you said that Bloomsbury wanted this book to be published for students so they could get an accessible overview of the history of the GDR and also interesting scholarship that's going on about the GDR even today. My question to you is perhaps, why should undergraduate students learn more about the GDR?
I think East Germany is still a really interesting topic, both within the larger field of German history and in general in the 20th century. Within German history, the problem you've always got sort of the black hole of interest in the Nazi period, that this is always something that sort of is a huge draw. And I think it's really unfortunate that it tends to overshadow a broader understanding of both how Germany came to the period of Nazi rule and also the fallout from it. The GDR is really interesting to me as looking at the radically different pathways that one can take out of a fascist period. That when we especially in comparison with West Germany, that when you look at the GDR as a way a group of people and a group of states tried to figure out what you do in the wake of dictatorship, and in this case, it was creating a different dictatorship, but one that was very self-consciously organized around the idea that in the wake of the Third Reich, radical changes need to be made in order to recreate a country. These decisions are being made by people in the Soviet Union as an occupying power, by German communists who are trying to create these things on below, and then also shaped by a diverse range of the population. Some people who are ex-Nazis, some who had been victims of the Nazis, trying to get together to figure out how to make this. I think beyond just its founding, that East Germany is really a compelling case for trying to understand how dictatorships work on a mass level, understanding them not just as sort of a single person barks some orders, their secret police minions go out and a brainwashed population does their bidding. But in the case of East Germany in particular, the complexity of how you create an authoritarian society under the banner of a totalizing ideology. And when you get into the nuts and bolts of this, how much of society is organized not just around the threat of the secret police, even though this is ubiquitous in the GDR, sort of the mass networks of informants, but also all the more mundane ways you construct these systems through mandatory membership in mass organizations, how you create systems where basic necessities of life like housing, food are tied up in your workplace. And generally, how do you create sort of this dense social web of dictatorship where everyone has to participate and enthusiastically participate in a lot of ways, while at the same time, under circumstances where you have a massive asymmetry of power, where the actual decision-making is concentrated at the top, but the people in charge are incredibly dependent on the masses of the citizenry to make anything happen. I think it really highlights these contradictions and the complexities of what it means to be a functional dictatorship.
So how can this case study, the GDR, be understood in a more global context?
This is really where the last 10, 15 years of scholarship is coming into play in terms of the synthesis that this book represents. That East German history was in the 1990s really framed around the idea that this is a second German dictatorship that needs to be understood on its own terms. It needs to be sort of processed as part of this democratic transition. And a lot of the work was focusing on East Germany, specifically within this national context, for the purposes of the German liberal democratic state understanding itself. And this is really broadened out, not just in terms of trying to understand East Germany as an entangled history with West Germany. It's one that you really can't write without having to understand what's happening at West Germany at the same time, because the two countries' politics are always so connected, both on a high-level term in terms of diplomacy, but also in terms of everyday life, consumption, the way the population understood what is a normal country. All of these things are always in reference to West Germany as its capitalist Western counterpart. At the same time, there's been a real push to try and embed East German history in the rest of Eastern Europe. Because you have unification in 1990, often East Germany sort of gets pulled out of the larger narrative trajectory of Eastern Europe, because it's now sort of been pulled into a Western European country or a Central European country. But Eastern was very closely tied in economically, culturally, politically with the rest of the Warsaw Pact. You had movement of labor, you had economic integration, and these were also countries where the politics of reaction, reform, dissent were incredibly important in shaping what was happening on the ground in the GDR, even if East Germany was always sort of treated as a country somewhat apart, as this frontline state, always in a privileged position, and as the only Eastern Bloc country with a Western counterpart, always one that was slightly different. And then finally, the real push to try and look at the GDR in a global context, which seems counterintuitive on first contact, because the key thing that most people understand about East Germany is its isolation. And there's this perception of this sort of totalitarian state, hermit kingdom, hiding behind this concrete wall in which sort of no one can really get to. The people behind it don't really know much about the outside world. And the restrictions on migration are a massive element of East German history that we can't pretend aren't there. But this really cuts out the importance of people who are migrating to the GDR. You start having foreign students coming there in the 1950s. You have political refugees. You have communists fleeing from Ba'athist Iraq. You've got Chileans escaping from the Pinochet coup after the fall of the Allende government. You have a very small cluster of Cambodians escaping the Cambodian genocide. And this idea of East Germany as a safe haven for refugees, even while it's a state that is shooting its own citizens for trying to leave without permission, is something that is really important to grapple with as sort of the central contradiction of the state. At the same time, again, sort of understanding how East Germany fits into global economics, that this is always a hard sell trying to get students to care about global economic systems because they think it's sort of this dry, complicated topic that involves currency exchange systems that are beyond their interest. But one of the things you see with the GDR is that it gets into this vortex of external debt in order to provide enough consumer goods to the population to try and maintain the political monopoly of the Socialist Unity Party. And this question of foreign debt, how foreign financing works, the capacity of the state to sort of sell goods on the open market, and also to find trade deals with other countries where they can barter, is really at the heart of whether or not East Germany survives in the 70s and 80s. So you can have things like coffee prices skyrocketing because of a blight in Brazil. And this has a downstream effect of suddenly causing domestic unrest in East Germany that the political elite have to contend with, because people have come to see coffee as a basic element of everyday life and a basic necessity of what it means to live in a civilized country. So on the other hand, you have the GDR, which sort of touted itself as a sort of great peaceful country, one that's there defending against the resurgence of fascism. And East Germany is also a significant arms dealer because it's one of the things that the GDR can produce that is wanted on the international market. They're good at producing military trucks. They're good at producing Kalashnikovs. And when they're trading with countries, particularly in the global south, in the Middle East, sort of military arms for oil, for coffee, for other products that you can't make in East Germany, like cocoa, this becomes really the lifeblood of how the country sustains itself. And if you take away this global lens and just make it into a series of sort of domestic choices, it really leaves out the constraints the political elite were under, because while they have seemingly unrestricted political power, they're really at the whim of a lot of these sort of global economic forces.
I wanted to come back to the issue of these refugees who came from other countries into the GDR. And I wanted to ask, what was attractive for outsiders about the GDR?
If you ended up in the GDR as a refugee, it was for political reasons. So in the case, really the first refugees who would come there are people fleeing Greece after the royalists had crushed the communists in the civil war immediately after World War II. It's a fairly small population, only a few hundred people. This extends into other groups who are usually fleeing brutal crackdowns by authoritarian regimes and often fleeing the very real possibility of death. So in the case of Greek communists, but then also looking at, say, Iraqi communists in the 1970s who are trying to flee the Ba'athist regime under Saddam Hussein. They're actually put under specific protection of the Stasi as students, who are then sort of also treated as sort of quasi-political refugees. And then, as I mentioned, you have some people who happen to be in the GDR from Cambodia when the genocide starts under the Khmer Rouge. There's also some people, there's an ambiguity there too. You have people who come to the GDR as students and then try to avoid going back to their home country for political reasons. So again, with Iraq, people who don't want to go back to fight in the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. And also once you get into the contract worker program, the guest worker system that they had in East Germany, where you had people initially from other Eastern Bloc countries like Hungary and Poland. This expanded out to Cuba, Algeria, and then in the largest numbers, Mozambique, Angola, and Vietnam by the 80s. Particularly people coming from Mozambique that going to work in the GDR was also a way to escape having to fight against the anti-communist insurgency that was raging in Mozambique at the time. So you have this situation where foreigners who are in the GDR, you really run a gamut sometimes of students who are also refugees, people who are there as guest workers who are also trying to flee something. In the case of Southwest Africa, what becomes Namibia, there's a number of children who are sent to basically be educated away from the war zone in the ongoing conflict with apartheid South Africa and the civil war that's taking place. So in this case, on the one hand, you have a lot of people in East Germany who are willing to risk their life and sometimes lose their life trying to flee the country to move off into the West, particularly West Germany, where they're immediately given citizenship. And at the same time, you have a very small, much smaller stream of people who are at the same time trying to get into East Germany as a matter of life and death, which I think in this case, in the global context of things, that for some people, East Germany is an intolerable place to live. One where they're continuously conscious of a sense that they're lacking political freedom, they're lacking economic opportunity. On the other hand, you look at, say, some of the Vietnamese workers who came to the GDR. For them, they're leaving post-unification Vietnam, which is still in rubble. It's an extremely poor country, one that's also subject to very intense political controls as well. And for them, East Germany is a place where they can work in a factory that's usually fairly safe. And a lot of people did a lot of sort of side hustles working in the gray market. You had a lot of Vietnamese people who worked in, so the textile industry. They could make jeans for people on the side and using that buy a lot of products that were unavailable in Vietnam, ship them home and sort of create this transnational sort of gray market economy, working on the side to get money to buy goods, to ship them back to Vietnam where their relatives could then sell them to people in the local market. So there's all these sort of micro histories of different groups who are coming through, which is, if you're just sort of looking at this on the surface level of the political history, completely invisible. But under the surface, there's a lot going on.
So it's difficult to miss the global dimensions of the story you're telling here and of the recent research that's been going into the GDR. And I wanted to ask, for those in the audience who are not professional historians, could you explain where the Leibniz Center for Contemporary Historical Research in Potsdam fits in the overall research landscape?
It's a really great place to finish off a project like this, because the ZZF, since the 1990s, since its founding, has really been dedicated to trying to expand perspectives on what it means to study East German history. And historians at the ZZF in the 1990s were crucial to, it's usually called the cultural turn, trying to sort of move outside of Cold War totalitarian perspectives and understand new ways of looking at East Germany, both sort of political history, social history, economic. And there's a time, instead of just looking at the sort of question of state versus society, dissent versus collaboration, you had really interesting projects by people like Patrice Putulis, who got into sort of consumer history, looking at the development of particularly this chain of rotisserie chicken restaurants, and looking at this problem of sort of how do you fulfill the needs of people in a modern consumer society under the conditions of a socialist shortage economy and a dictatorship, and the pressures people were under to sort of create good consumer experiences for people in spite of this gray totalitarian image of everyone subsiding on old potatoes. And there's sort of this ongoing problem of how to reconcile these two aspects of the state, the coercive side, but also the one that's trying to sort of make people happy as modern day consumers. On the other hand, trying to look at this sort of everyday history, which was really pioneered by another great recently departed historian, Alf Lüdke. But you have a lot of people at ZZF who are crucial in trying to understand everyday experiences of people and the sites of negotiation between people and entities of the state in their everyday lives. So things like people working in factories where there's a degree of freedom people could have knowing that they couldn't necessarily be easily replaced as workers because you had huge worker shortages due to all the amount of emigration, demographic problems from so many people who died in the war. But instead of simply seeing this just through the lens of an all-powerful state, all-powerful sort of managers, looking at how people through everyday willfulness, through just being difficult, deciding to creatively interpret directives they were given, you don't have outright resistance, outright challenging of political authority, but you have a lot of people who are trying to shape their everyday life to their own interests, requirements, and needs in ways that don't actually rise to the level of outright resistance or armed struggle in any way. And so in this way, trying to get at this sort of one of the real paradoxes of East German history is this long-term period of stability, the seeming total control of the state, followed by an incredibly rapid collapse at the end of the 1980s, where everything just falls apart like a house of cards, the Berlin Wall opens, and East Germany stops existing. And the ZZF was always really a pioneering institution for this, and there's dozens of people whose work I've cited in the book who have worked at the ZZF at different times, and kind of standing on the shoulders of giants, that's standing on the shoulders of many different people who are now my colleagues. So it's been a real privilege to have a chance to really highlight that work and show how it all comes together.
I'd like to pivot now away from your most recent book and toward one of your current projects, which is the Volkswagen Stiftung, or the Volkswagen Foundation funded project, Illiberal Constitutionalisms. For those listeners who are not familiar with this project, could you tell us a bit about this project?
The idea with the liberal constitutionalism is this stems from primarily looking at Hungary and Poland in recent years, but also trying to look in general at the post-socialist Central European countries. The trend amongst the authoritarian conservative right to try to take the institutions, the language, the imagery of the liberal transition, and turn these different institutions into a vehicle for an increasingly illiberal and authoritarian society. And the term is one taken from Viktor Orban in Hungary, where he talks about this idea of sort of creating an illiberal democracy. And one of the things we're trying to explore is this problem that's come up of a number of movements that are not just contesting the idea of liberal democracy as it is, but trying to recreate society and the constitutional order around an illiberal vision of society while doing so in the name of liberal freedoms, rights, sort of democracy, realizing the will of the majority in civil society. And one of the arguments we wanted to try and make was that when we started this project, it sort of seemed like East Central Europe was this problematic backwards place that was sliding towards authoritarianism again, uniquely compared to the rest of the West. And since then, you have the rise of the far right in France with Donald Trump in the United States, this increasingly illiberal authoritarian trend that's happened where East Central Europe has moved from being the deviant outlier who just people who'd never quite got around to realizing transition to possibly being a guide to the future of how forces can work within existing liberal democratic constitutional systems and recreate them from within in order to realize an illiberal future.
You just talked about taking these liberal moments or liberal traditions and turning them into illiberal ones. Can you give me a few examples of what liberal traditions might mean?
So in the case of what I'm working on is particularly the German far right, that one of the things you see in German public democratic culture is the idea that 1989, within public memory, as an important event for the realization of human rights, both as parliamentary democracy, political rights to free speech, but also the protection of a larger pluralistic public sphere, one in which there's protection for minorities while at the same time a political system that's there to deliver on the will of the majority. In this case, what's interesting about sort of the former East Germany and now the larger scene in Germany today is that you see particularly the AfD as a party, but then a lot of other movements, people in far-right intellectual circles, coming from the new right, so-called, that they're trying to recreate East German history alongside the German present. So trying to take 1989 and move it from being sort of a triumph for an international movement dedicated to human rights, democracy, pluralism, and making it into a triumph of the German nation, which had never truly been realized. So this is an unfinished revolution that needs to be completed now by reinforcing rights for Germans over rights for non-Germans, implementing systems to reinforce rights along the idea of sort of patriarchal families in which families have more control over children, more control over education in a way that is specifically designed around the idea of trying to reduce recognition of LGBTQ communities, the idea of minority rights for ethnic groups, religious groups, and particularly the idea of sort of cementing a specific hierarchy of who is particularly German and has constitutional rights and who is outside that space of protection. And one of the places you see this now is this conflict between a liberal understanding of national self-determination, of Germany as a free democratic country under the rule of law, and a push in the different direction of self-determination as the self-determination of the German folk, specifically an ethno-nationalist project to create politics around just those who are members of the folk. And the argument that giving political or civil freedoms to non-Germans is a violation of the self-determination of the German nation. So it's really trying to push not just the idea that we should take away rights from people, but in order to realize constitutional rights in their true form, what we need to do is implement a very hierarchized society, one that specifically separates people out on an ethno-nationalist basis. And this is done in the name of completing a revolution for democracy. So I think in this way, it's instead of sort of the traditional line of the far right of basically saying the German constitution is bunk, it's a Western imposition, we need to get rid of it, it's not coming for a full frontal attack on liberal democratic institutions, but trying to take them, repurposing them, hijacking them, appropriating their language, and using it to push a far-right agenda.
You mentioned that this idea of illiberal constitutionalism was originally invoked by Viktor Orban in Hungary. And I wanted to ask you, now that Peter Magyar has defeated Viktor Orban and his regime has been removed, do you think this heralds a larger sea change, or is it too early to be optimistic about that?
One of the things we've been looking at is this is a project where every month there's a new development that's relevant to one of the countries we've been looking at, which is primarily Hungary, Poland, Czechia, Germany, that in spite of sort of the euphoria of the end of the Orban system, institutionally, what he created is still in place. And it's a system in which a lot of power has been concentrated at the very top. And the question of reform in the future is very much in the hands of his successor, and a question of whether or not he will be able to personally undo all of these institutional changes. And looking at what happened in Poland after the peace government was voted out of office, it's been a very difficult process of trying to reestablish the judiciary as an independent body, a lot of confusion over who is legitimately an appointed judge and who is not, what are the legal decisions that are actually valid. And one of the things that has been interesting in terms of looking at Poland as an example of a country sort of moving in the other direction is that these are changes that are very difficult to undo. Well, there's a certain amount of resilience to a liberal democratic constitutional order. There's also a resilience to this illiberal constitutionalism. And the process of trying to unpick these things is one that's difficult to explain to voters because it's often very technical. It's about legal institutional problems. And it's one that isn't very popular for people who are hoping for a new government to deliver quickly. So in the American parlance, throw the bastards out and to punish people from the old regime, while at the same time trying to now re-implement pluralist democracy, minority rights, rule of law, and all these other things. There's really sort of these cross purposes that are introduced that make it very difficult to reverse these things. And we saw the resurgence of peace in Poland already, where the government is now divided once again between a presidency and the executive branch, which is pushing in an illiberal direction while the government is trying to sort of revert everything to back to the status quo of 10 years ago. So this is the danger in Hungary, and it's in the case of Czechia or Germany, these are still imagined ideas for the future. But it's one of the things to consider in this case that the idea that once you let the far right into power and they fail on their own terms, people will reject them and it'll bring them down as a force. I think what we've seen is that that instead of just seeing this as people come in and dismantle a system and you just have to rebuild it, that it's a very sticky process of repurposing institutions towards an illiberal authoritarian agenda. And it's almost impossible to simply wind back the clock. It's really a matter of trying to move forward to a new kind of institutional order, one that hasn't been seen before, and one that is much trickier to sort of come up with through democratic means and simply saying, let's go back to how things were.
What might that new institutional order look like?
One of the things that got us to this place in our collective project's argument is that you had a lot of liberal democratic institutions that were increasingly understood to be illegitimate because they involved demobilizing the population. They had an increasing distance between the institutions of democracy, institutions of law, and any kind of sort of popular mobilization or political engagement. And it is a stereotype of these things. Sort of, we need more popular engagement. We need more democracy. But it is really this problem of how do you get people to actually feel like they have a stake as citizens again? And simply saying we need to go back to the institutions that helped to create this crisis in the first place is untenable. But it's also a problem that there is no quick fix silver bullet to say we simply need to make these constitutions sort of authoritarian proof in the future. We just need a few changes. That this is really a society-wide question of commitment to democratic values beyond simply just total majoritarianism. Sort of a nice, simple list of priorities. But I think what we're trying to do is get to a place where we can try and understand the problem better before we can even tackle the problem of what to do next.
Ned, we're at the end of our time, and I want to thank you very much for yours.
Thank you so much.
Der ZZF Podcast aus dem Leibniz Zentrum für zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam.
On the upcoming episodes, we're going to talk with members from the team from the Illiberal Constitutional Project. So we'll be discussing these questions and others. Thank you, Ned.